Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, ricksmithshow.com. So, interesting day across the pond. I was wondering how things were going to work out with the Brexit deal. Theresa May yesterday saying, you know, history would remember the people who voted there today. Evidently not a good day for her. I'm here to share some thoughts on that and also keep us up to date on what's going on around the world. Our good friend Luke Vargas, Talk Media News. Luke, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
So, interesting day on the Brexit.
Yeah, that's for certain. I mean, it's remarkable because all that has really occurred is we've taken a wide open array of, as I see it, five different Brexit options, spanning from the political right, a no-deal Brexit, so you leave the EU with no arrangements in place, a little bit less conservative, you have a better deal than the one Theresa May was currently able to agree to, but that actually sort of reduces the integration between the EU and the United Kingdom going forward. Then you had Theresa May's deal, which we all knew was dead in the water. That's right in the middle of the road. Then you have the option four, as I saw it going in today, was a hypothetical better deal that could be worked out with the European Union that gave sort of set up a tighter integration between the UK and EU going forward. Clearly, that it doesn't seem to be where people are going either, and especially where conservatives want to go. And then all the way sort of on the opposite side is the second referendum. You know, let's go take this back to the people, maybe give them the same vote that they had in 2016, give them a two-part question where you sort of maybe get a little bit more of an insight into what the pro-Brexit people actually want, like the severity of their intent to Brexit. And all we've done in the process today is whittle that down from five options to four, as I see it. Theresa May's deal has been taken off of the table. But much like, and I keep using this analogy on the radio, and it probably has limitations, but you had our healthcare reform debate with President Trump in his first year in office, right? And the Republicans couldn't get the support from their own caucus because of problems with two factions. One was the Freedom Caucus. Remember, they were saying, oh, we've got to really scrap all of that linkages back to the Affordable Care Act. And then the other end, you had people like Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski were saying, you know, our populations really like some of these protections in Obamacare. We have to do more to protect that. And, you know, Republicans and the president keep saying, we're going to work it out, like make a deal. And it wound up being impossible because to do the deal, you needed to simultaneously go further to the right and go further to the left. And so I don't see a clear indication coming out of today's mess that anyone has a sense of how a deal can be worked out, right? That you can't simultaneously sever the relationship further with the European Union and hope that you're going to get Labour Party voters to cross over and support that, nor can you go, you know, further to, you know, towards the let's have a second referendum or let's be a little bit more integrated with the EU in the future and hope to get any more conservatives in doing that. So I don't see how the math works. Nor do I think there's any sort of consensus view among the conservatives about how they're going to proceed next. And right now, actually, just before we got on the phone, I was cutting audio from three different MPs of the Conservative Party who all going into the vote today had exceedingly different and basically views that were at odds with each other about, you know, sort of what their votes meant. And there's just not really a way I see to reconcile all of it. So I think the mess continues.
Yeah. Is there a moment where you've made the decision by default? It just happens. I mean, is there a drop dead date on this? Cause I think like 2 months down the road, right? I mean, isn't that when everything's supposed to blow up? And if you don't have anything, it's kind of like a default. It's just going to blow up.
Yeah. I mean, the drop dead date technically really is the Brexit date insofar as if really we get there and neither the UK government has worked out a fix or a delay, nor has the EU given any concessions, you just rip the Band-Aid off and you have this scenario that they've been having these sort of plans for where you have tons of trucks, you know, getting stuck at the border, you know, trying to go through, you know, getting on ships at ports, you know, like literally a breakdown of the flow of commerce and people through airports because no arrangements are in place for Brexit. That's possible. I think, you know, at some point you would think that perhaps members of the ruling Conservative Party who right now think a better deal is within reach, be it a little bit more conservative or a little bit more liberal in its content, will realize that unicorn deal doesn't exist. and maybe that's a week before the vote or before Brexit, maybe it's a month before. Clearly that hasn't set in yet, so I don't know when that would come. And on the European side, it's not certain that they won't negotiate further if it really looks like a no-deal Brexit is going to happen. Yeah. Now, clearly, I think they've been savvy in giving off the impression that they're done talking, and it puts a lot of pressure on the Brits. But I'm not at all certain that 5 days out, a week out from a no-deal Brexit, that Brussels doesn't start getting a little bit more cooperative. And I think that wouldn't be a bad move, necessarily. It really is worth sort of pulling back and looking at the forces that are changing European politics. Like, it's pretty clear they, you know, the thinking was on the European Union side, we've got to make Brexit so painful that nobody wants to follow suit. And I think to an extent, the Brits have sent that message on their own because of how much it's wrecked their own politics trying to do this. But on the other hand, I think there's a little more nuance to it that, you know, a good slice of European citizens feel like it's actually unfair and wrong for the European Union to dictate in the way it is doing that, and that it should be a little bit more of a cooperative negotiator, even with a country that wants to leave the European Union. You know, like, be fair. And there, I kind of agree with that in parts. I mean, there is a sense that, you know, there's these decisions being handed down by unaccountable councils of people in Brussels that impact the lives of, you know, hundreds of millions of people on the continent. Maybe they should be more responsive to the British concerns. And so it's possible you might see a softening from the EU side as well. But I do not think I can predict when that sort of moment of reckoning is going to occur. And it's clearly making everyone nervous that we've gotten this close already.
Going to see how this plays out. Some interesting news also today coming back here to the U.S. Donald Trump, again, you know, beaten up on NATO, I guess several times last year, said that he wants to pull out. I heard a lot today that this is, you know, like number one on Putin's checklist. And, you know, you combine this with Friday's story that the FBI has been investigating Trump with his ties to Putin and Russia and all of that. It just seems like now's not really a great time for that to have come out.
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty illuminating New York Times report. I mean, we have heard Trump criticize NATO in uncharacteristically strong terms, dating back to, I think, the David Sanger article in the New York Times around the time of the Republican National Convention in 2016, which was a huge bombshell at the time, that he would even really sort of question the value of the alliance in vague terms. According to the New York Times, he's done much more than that, that he's really been sort of saying, tell me finally one last time why I shouldn't just get us out of this whole thing. And that, you know, as some people have told me today, it would have been to even as a commentator talk about that as a possibility. You would have been laughed out of planning rooms or academic meetings. I mean, it's just that is a third rail of a type that you rarely see ever getting serious traction. But we have to, unfortunately, consider this serious, given the fact that Trump seems more and more preoccupied with this notion of pulling out over time. It's not at all about, hey, let's get the European countries to incrementally increase their military spending. It's not at all about, hey, let's maybe shift around our deployments or consolidate our bases to save cash. He seems to just really think this alliance is not worthwhile to America. And again, what's amazing is that as much as this is a policy where he basically stands on his own, even John Bolton, even Mike Pompeo, many of the other folks who are really willing to go along with anything Trump says because they're sycophantic or because they just happen to have an unusual ideological overlap with Trump, even they don't go along with this. And yet, there was a tweet from the president the other night. I don't have it in front of me, and I'm going to have to sort of paraphrase it. But it seemed to offer sort of a glimpse into how Trump views things. It's obviously a shutdown tweet. And he responds to some article in which he says, you know, they're criticizing me for having a White House that's embroiled in chaos. Well, I'm looking around, and this place is basically empty. And the impression you got from this tweet was that he loves this, right? That, in fact, it's better to have an empty White House where Trump is the only one calling the shots and doesn't need to hear Bolton's stupid reasons for why we're still in NATO, then that's the environment he likes. And so, again, yes, I don't think there's many Republicans in Congress hardly anyone in the military, hardly anyone in the State Department or the National Security Council who think even joking about a possible withdrawal from NATO is a good idea. And yet if Trump seems to be relishing operating as a lone actor in Washington as much as he seems to be, that, you know, he only needs to win himself over here. And I don't know. That's, I think we've got to seriously talk about this. And I hope the many and diverse voices out there who can explain the benefits of the NATO alliance choose this moment to make their case in the most eloquent possible way, because I think this is clearly a position that Trump shares with a very, very small cohort of people. And unfortunately, one of them is Vladimir Putin, and that ought to make us suspicious.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as I was thinking about today, we also heard today that the notes from the interpreter that Trump used while speaking with Putin, evidently his notes were confiscated, sworn to secrecy. And you start thinking about, you know, if that's the case, because I've actually never heard of that before. Look, I don't think the interpreter is going to go on CNN or on, you know, on MSNBC and blab what happened. But to actually confiscate their notes and this whole, you know, blood pact of secrecy is, you know, kind of a bit much. And it kind of now makes me go, what exactly did you say?
Well, I think the really concerning thing about this is not just, you know, what is, well, there are two things. One is that people have said, and I've been on some conservative talk shows today in which these hosts have said, you know, it's Trump's right to have a meeting one-on-one with the foreign head of state. And if they want to have a, you know, a chat without a ton of people in the room, that's a great thing. And I sort of, there's some sort of base appeal to that until you consider that all of the reasons why you would want someone who knows the region, who knows Russian intelligence language, who knows the way that they manipulate their view of the world, to correct the record if and when, and we have to assume it's when, Vladimir Putin tells some sort of lie or represents U.S. policy in an unfair way and tries to appeal to President Trump, and Trump goes along with it. You really want someone in the room to be able to correct the record on the spot and to put, you know, to tell Putin what's going to fly and what isn't. That still leaves room for Trump to negotiate. I don't think anyone's calling for an assistant to be in there blocking Trump from talking. But, you know, if as I forget if it was Evelyn Farkas or someone else was saying earlier this week, you know, you want, you know, if Putin makes a vague reference to a peace deal and references the name of the capital of Moldova, and Trump clearly doesn't know what that capital is or even what Moldova is, you want someone to know that's the line that the Russians are thinking. Like the and what also appears to have not happened, and it is part and parcel with the banning of the circulation of the notes, is that there wasn't, at least until 5 days after the meeting, the typical debriefing that the president typically does with members of the National Security Council and the intelligence agencies and other White House staff immediately after the meeting. And that's really useful to do that, even if those people aren't in the room for the actual meeting. The president would then relay back, hey, the Russians are thinking X. Putin seems to be, his right arm is shaking. You know, all these little details which could tell you a lot about your adversaries. Trump, for at least 5 days after the meeting with Putin, refused to do that debrief with anyone. And that is where I think, and I often come back to this with the whole, a lot of the characters in the Mueller probe, I'm not sure everything they did was criminal, but at a lot of junctures, it's just sort of unpatriotic. And it really, you know, suggests the number one focus for a lot of people in this administration, including the president at times, is not America's interest. It would be terrific for our intelligence understanding of the Russians if President Trump had been willing to talk to our national security advisors about all of the little details of that conversation so we could build a better portrait of the Russians and what their foreign policy is. Instead, he doesn't think that's necessary, and the whole country suffers when we don't get that information. So there's so much that was bothersome about the report about the Putin meeting and this report about NATO, and it scares me, to be honest.
No, I mean, absolutely does. And, you know, look, you know, Trump's one of those guys. I think you're right. I don't think he knows where Moldova is or the capital, and I also don't think he knows very much. And, you know, this is why you want to surround yourself with the very best people. But as you pointed out, there's nobody around. And that's the scary thing, because you put something in his head and he regurgitates it. Kind of like, you know, there was the Russian talking point about that, you know, Afghanistan was asking for it because they kept evidently, you know, they're justifying going into Afghanistan.
Right. Right.
Because, you know, the terrorists were attacking Russia. I'm going, really? And then, you know, Trump regurgitated that as well. You know, so again, you know, this is one of those guys where you just, I wouldn't give him the keys to the shed that just had the shovel in it, let alone the keys to the, you know, nuclear codes.
I remember it, and it seems like such an innocent time in retrospect, when the president of Japan, or the prime minister of Japan, Abe, was the first world leader to ask for a visit with President Trump, or maybe even then President-elect Trump. And it was a clear effort by Abe and everything he was saying in those first few meetings to flatter Trump at every turn. And then when Trump in turn went to Japan, he brought him to a golf course. He served a hamburger to President Trump. Like, he made sure that none of the Japanesey things that Donald Trump wouldn't like were part of the visit. And he completely knew how to win Trump over. And I think at the time we said, oh, isn't that, that's fine. Like, that's great. You know, Japan's an ally. If they can figure out a way to get this guy to download language and thinking that benefits our bilateral relationship, that's great. But clearly there's a negative lesson that other leaders were learning as people like Abe did that dance, which is that, yes, you know, Trump can be manipulated. Like, if you want him to convince him to do good things, here's a script to do it. But if you want to convince Donald Trump to, you know, start believing in an ideology that's end up gonna harm his country and his people, there are probably ways to induce him to favor those ideas. And I think we have clearly entered the era where it's not about hamburgers and things anymore. It's about the Turkish president finding a language to communicate policies to the president that he'll believe in. It seems the Russian president may have figured out a way to do that. And I don't think it's really all that subtle either. I mean, I think there's a lot of world leaders who maybe struggle to come up with good foreign policy vis-a-vis other leaders, have found that Trump is a relatively easy playbook to crack. And that is a vulnerability for our foreign policy.
Yeah, it's scary, 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 scary stuff. And I'm hoping this Mueller thing wraps up soon and we move on from this nightmare. You brought up hamburgers, though. Did you see the Clemson football team at the White House yesterday? Hamburgers, McDonald's, Wendy's, I forget what the other one was, Burger King, had some pizza, all served on silver platters.
How large would this delegation of athletes need to be to eat, as the president said, 1,000 hamburgers? I mean, I just like that to me. There's some magic number for President Trump of the factor of exaggeration that he's prone to when it comes to, you know, lying about numbers. He originally said he bought, I think, 300 hamburgers, right, and then it went up to 1,000. And this does, I'm going to just put out there that somewhere around 3, 3.5 is the factor by which Trump thinks it's okay to exaggerate. I mean, this is true about the cost of the wall, the size of the migrant caravan, you know, the percentage of territory ISIS has holds on to, the number of fighters left, and all sorts of things. I mean, the economic cost of the shutdown. I would be curious if someone could compile these numbers to find what Trump's range is. 3.1 or 3 or whatever is so high compared to other presidents, but that does seem to be the rate of exaggeration he's comfortable with. It's crazy.
Crazy, crazy stuff. And finally, evidently China is going to be executing a Canadian citizen over drug charges.
It's a creepy story. I'm going to put aside whether or not this guy is guilty. The Chinese allege this man, Robert Schellenberg, 36 years old, who was arrested in northeastern China several years ago, was part of a plot to send 400 pounds of methamphetamine in pellet form inside automobile tires, and had evidently been scoping out all of the means of actually carrying this out. It doesn't sound like he ever got to the point of actually doing the drug charges, more like conspiracy to be part of the drug trade. But let's put aside whether he's guilty or not. He was sentenced in November to 15 years in prison, which in a country that has a zero tolerance on any drugs is still very high, but probably not all that unprecedented. Then in December, Canada arrests the CFO of this giant Chinese telecom company, Huawei, on behalf of the U.S., which alleges she was engaged in fraud to violate U.S. sanctions on Iran. And this absolutely sparked outrage in China. And they retaliated by arresting several Canadians, including academic Michael Kovrig of the International Crisis Group and a businessman. And they've been held on, seem like, pretty bogus charges ever since. And so it already looked like we were engaged in some sort of, like, you arrest one of our people, we're going to just arbitrarily arrest some of your people. And these human lives become pawns in this bigger diplomatic conflict. This is a huge escalation. I mean, now so what you saw after the arrest of the Chinese executive was media outlets in China bringing up this case again and sort of saying, like, turning up the heat on a sentencing that had already occurred. And then it seems in this vacuum in which this case is getting all this attention in China, they decide to reopen it and do a resentencing, a one-day retrial on Monday, in which the charge is upgraded from 15 years imprisonment to death. I think there's clearly evidence that this is abnormal, that this was a resentencing that was driven by political calculation. And that shows you how tense this situation has become. And I'll just note very briefly what the Canadians are feeling like they're really on their own right now. And you would hope that, they probably, and you would be not wrong to think that they probably agree with us on a lot of the things that we're taking issue with in the trade war. They've already arrested this Chinese woman on our behalf. You'd think we would really intervene here to try and help them out, to give them some political cover in this big spat they have with China. We're not doing that.
No.
Nor are we helping them out as they are getting really diplomatically punished by Saudi Arabia for letting in that 18-year-old girl who was fleeing violence at the hands of her family members. Once again, our ally just north of the border could use our assistance, I think, in relationships in settling the disputes with these two countries, and yet America isn't there. And I think it's pretty glaring absence of American assistance to a core ally.
Yeah, the guy we got sitting in the White House all by himself now with a whole bunch of hamburgers, failing us at every turn, in my view. That's sad, sad stuff. Luke, I appreciate the time. Good stuff as always.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Our good friend Luke Vargas, Talk Media News. Make sure you check out his podcast every day. It comes out with a 2-minute podcast to get your world news. We play it here on the program. So you can just tune in right here to hear it every day. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith.